Naturally Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts. I'm Steve Larkham. Today on the podcast, I'll be chatting to Dr. Willie Weir, a researcher at the Wellcome Trust Centre for Molecular Parasitology here at Glasgow. Willie's latest research, published in the journal eLife, has been making headlines round the world. Today, I'll be asking him about the research behind the news stories and what it's like for a scientist to deal with the press. Willie, hello.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Willie, your exciting new research has been all about trypanosomiasis, the parasite that causes African sleeping sickness. Before I ask you to explain what it is exactly that you've found, can you give us just a little bit of background about African sleeping sickness, what we know about it and what it does?
Certainly. So African sleeping sickness is a serious disease that occurs in sub-Saharan Africa. The parasite itself is a unicellular organism, so it's a protozoa. It's a very ancient parasite, and it's been in the probably been in the animal population for a very long time. There's different forms of the disease. So you have an East African form of the disease, which is very acute, but there's actually very few cases at the moment. And then you have a West African form of the disease, which is a lot more chronic, but actually results in a far greater sort of disease burden. So it's the West African form of disease that we've been studying.
And so do you have African collaborators that you work on this with?
Yes. So I work in Dr. Annette McLeod's research group, and the group has very strong links with scientists in West Africa, specifically in the Côte d'Ivoire and Burkina Faso. So we're very much reliant on these people to collect samples from us and send them across for analysis.
So I've seen some of the headlines behind your latest research paper, including things like zero sex is a killer, bugs' weird sex life could make it go extinct, say Scottish scientists. What exactly is it about the sex life of these parasites that you find so interesting, Willie?
Well, I guess my research in the last 10-15 years has been looking at parasite populations and working out if they have sex or not. So when we came upon this particular trypanosome, we were very interested in it because all the sort of preliminary data and early research work done by a great many people suggested it didn't have sex, but no one was able to put their finger on it and say it never ever ever has sex. So what we've done is we've been able to demonstrate that the parasite is strictly asexual, so sex just is never a feature in its life history.
And I understand that one of the major findings from your paper is that you found some evidence for something called the mesosyn effect using this parasite. Can you explain to us maybe exactly what that is, the mesosyn effect?
Okay, well, what you have to think about is you need to be comparing sexual organisms with non-sexual organisms. So if you think of the sort of norm as being a sexual organism, that means if you've got a population and the population goes through a generation, then what you have is lots of cross-mating between different individuals in the population. So the next generation is genetically, if you like, a mixture of the previous generation. When you look at something like the trypanosomes, what we find is like each generation is almost like a carbon copy of the previous generation. So it's a very sort of striking difference you see between that and a sort of normal type sexual population. So what we've been doing is we've been looking at the mutations that like build up in the genome. So even though the parasite isn't having sex, the parasite is undergoing small mutations here and there in the genome, and different members of the population will be having different mutations in different places. So what we've done is we've sort of traced the mutations, if you like, and all the parasites that we've surveyed in the recent sample to try and work out when these mutations appeared in the evolution of the parasite population and what they mean. So when you look at the pattern of these variations, we can use that to infer various things about the evolutionary processes that have taken place. Now, if you have an organism that's diploid, so that has got two separate chromosomal copies for every chromosome. If you think of a normal sort of sexual organism, then through recombination, as time goes on and you go through the generations, these different copies, the different homologues become sort of scrambled up, if you like. What we have found, though, is in the trypanosomes, or the particular trypanosome that we're interested in, it's called T. gambiense, group 1. This particular trypanosome, the mutations that build up on one sort of chromosomal copy, one homologue, always stay in that homologue. So if you like, what we've got are two independently evolving chromosomes or homologues within single individuals. Now, because the organism isn't able to have sex, sex is quite a useful thing, as I say, for scrambling up the genetic information for the next generation. And this means that any mutations that are bad mutations, if you like, they can be lost through a process of natural selection. But if you're a trypanosome, the mutations just keep on building up, and this is called the genetic load. So what's probably happening is, all over the place, all these parasites, if a parasite has got a particularly bad mutation, a really serious one, then that parasite will die, and that's, if you like, the end of that line. But if it just has a slightly suboptimal mutation, or a blue mutation as it's called, then the parasite can probably struggle on, but it'll pass that mutation, that blue mutation, on to the next generation. So when we look at the parasite population just now, which has been on the go for hundreds, possibly a few thousand years, what we're looking at is an accumulation of all these slightly deleterious or neutral, or maybe some of them are slightly positive, mutations. And the deleterious ones, they can be thought of as the genetic load. Now, because the parasite can't get rid of these things, it's been thought of as a sort of ratchet effect as well. So another term that's often used along with genetic load and the measles effect is this business of Muller's ratchet. So that's the idea that the mutations, as they build up, they can't be lost. So getting back to your original question about the measles effect you asked all those minutes ago, the measles effect is a prediction based on the idea that these two chromosomal copies don't actually interact with each other in terms of mixing up their genetic code. So the prediction is, if you take one chromosome and, say for example, you draw a phylogenetic tree, and you take the other chromosome and draw a phylogenetic tree, both these chromosomes will hopefully produce the same tree. Now, if you were to try and do that with an organism that was sexual, then it would just be terrible. It would be a total mess, because the chromosomes, the homologues, are swapping sort of genetic code through the generations. But because these chromosomal homologues have been kept separate, then what you have got essentially are two independently evolving chromosomes. And because they've been sort of bound together in the same body, if you like, then they follow the same evolutionary pathway. So people in our institute study things like how lice co-evolve with birds. And when you look at their phylogenetic trees and you cross-compare them, they're very similar. And that's because basically both the organisms are intimately associated with each other. And this is sort of the same. So you can think of as one chromosomal homologue as being the parasite and the other being the host. And that's the way we approach some of the analysis, and we were actually able to demonstrate this measles effect. So what we found was quite a sort of strong signal for the two different chromosomal copies evolving in parallel, but actually separate from each other.
So am I right in thinking that this is the first time anyone's actually been able to experimentally demonstrate the measles effect?
Well, what we've been doing is we've been looking at field populations. So people have looked at other systems, sometimes experimentally, to try and find evidence of measles effect. But this is the first time anyone's demonstrated it at a genome-wide level. And the thing that I find quite exciting is the fact we can just basically, we don't actually have to do it experimentally. We can go to the field and just collect the samples. So we can use the real, if you like, the real genetic information that's sort of distributed in the population today, and then do these calculations and draw these quite strong inferences.
And where did you get the samples from?
The samples came from West Africa, so mainly they were in the Côte d'Ivoire and Burkina Faso. We also got a handful of samples from Cameroon as well, because we wanted samples that were sort of genetically different that we could use to cross-compare and just make sure our results sort of held, not just for the big populations that we were studying, but also for smaller samples from different populations. And what we found was that the if you draw these sort of phylogenetic trees to try and work out how the parasites are related to each other, they very much follow the geography. So if you like, one sort of branch in the tree is Côte d'Ivoire, another branch is is Burkina Faso. But if you look sort of low down in the tree, another branch has come off, and that represents the samples in Cameroon. So these places in West Africa that are generally a bit further apart, the genotypes seem to be a little bit further apart as well.
And the samples, they come from people that are sick with the parasite?
Yes. So that this particular form of trypanosomes, that there's not been an animal reservoir demonstrated. So really the only place we can find the parasite is in the tsetse flies and in humans. So all our samples have been collected from patients with the disease.
So Willie, from the point of view of these sick people, it's probably quite a good thing if the parasite builds up a genetic load of deleterious mutations, isn't it?
It is. So if you look at the sort of theoretical predictions, the prediction is if these mutations keep on going unchecked, then eventually they'll build up so much that the parasite is no longer viable and it'll enter this thing called an extinction vortex.
Sounds ominous.
It does sound pretty ominous, and it's going to be great if that actually happens. The problem is there's no way to really predict when this will happen, because it's going to be dependent on exactly where and how many of these little tiny blue mutations are getting picked up, how long it takes, and just how bad they are for the parasite. So whether it's going to happen in another 2,000 years or a million years or infinity time, it's impossible to say. So we can't be relying on that.
So unless it starts resorting to having sex again, it's such a chore to have sex. Unless it starts resorting to having sex again, Willie, is there any way that the parasite can compensate for this?
Well, one of our quite interesting findings, I think, is a very sort of strange, if you like, signature in the parasite's genome. So the first thing we did when we looked at the population sort of genetics was we looked at the whole population and we looked over all the chromosomes just to see where all the mutations lay. And a very interesting pattern popped up. And this was that some chromosomes had fairly large stretches of homozygosity. So that's a part of the chromosome where you don't actually see any sort of variation in one homologue to the other homologue. So the types of genetic marker that we are looking at are single nucleotide polymorphisms. So these are single nucleotides that mutate in the population, and we can use these as genetic markers for doing our analysis. You tend to find these things fairly widely scattered over the genome in general. Now, when we looked at our population, what we found was there were certain parts of the genome where they were fairly widely scattered, but there were certain sort of deserts in the genome where you didn't find any single nucleotide polymorphisms. So these were like long stretches of homozygosity. So we sort of termed them loss of heterozygosity, because presumably they started as sort of normal heterozygous chromosomes. And when we look at the pattern of these, we can actually see, and for some chromosomes in some areas, that sort of fresh, brand new loss of heterozygosity events have happened, and you have a particular individual, and it's only that individual that's got a loss of heterozygosity in one chromosome. And then you look at other areas, and you find that there's a loss of heterozygosity, but this loss of heterozygosity is actually replicated amongst a large number, and in some cases, all of the parasites we're looking at. So a mechanism that we believe the parasite has developed to try and get around this business of genetic load and Müller's ratchet is using a process called gene conversion. And what it does is, instead of a normal sexual sort of population, it's recombining. So the next generation, the genotypes are all recombined. So if there's any particularly bad mutations, they may be selected out. So as time goes on, as I say, deleterious mutations will be lost from the population. But for this parasite, it can't get rid of them through sex. So using this process of gene conversion, what it does is it takes it cuts and pastes the genetic code from the opposite chromosomal homologue onto the one with the deleterious mutation. And that's what gives rise to this business of loss of heterozygosity. So you might have a chromosome where you've got one slight variant of the genetic code in one homologue and another homologue. But after it's been through this process of gene conversion, all this variation has disappeared, and you've either got a version of the A homologue throughout the region, or a version of the B homologue throughout the region.
That's good. So if I understand it correctly, the parasite can copy and paste good bits, in inverted commas, from one chromosome onto bad bits on the other, but in the process it might lose some valuable genetic information at the same time.
That's exactly right. So the prediction is that this process cannot be used forever for spare parts. So if you take the view, as we do, that these sort of small deleterious blue mutations, these mutations that aren't lethal but they're not wonderful either, these are actually building up in both chromosomes. And after the parasite has went through one of these sort of loss of heterozygosity events, any of the slightly deleterious but not lethal mutations on the better chromosome will be copied onto the other one. So you're never able to completely get rid of deleterious mutations. So our feeling is that this process, it's maybe going to help, suppress Müller's ratchet in the short term. In the longer term, it's unlikely to have an effect. In fact, some people may argue that by copying over these blue mutations onto the chromosome, you're actually kind of contributing to Müller's ratchet, because you're fixing these mutations in the genome, and after the copy and pasting has been done, there's no spare part left to improve the genome from.
Excellent. So it's probably been quite an unusual process for you, the fact that you've published this really exciting and fascinating research, and it's been picked up by the press on a global scale, it's fair to say. How exactly did all that come about? How did the press get a hold of this story to start with? Do you want to talk me through it from the point of view of a researcher dealing with the press for the first time?
Certainly. Well, we knew we had quite an important story here, because people have been looking for proof of the Meislson effect for 20 years. So the first time, as I say, this is the first time it's been found at the genome-wide level. So we thought it'd be worthwhile speaking to the press about it. So we just went through the normal avenues at the university and generated a press release. There was a press release released from Glasgow, and there was also a press release released by the journal eLife. Both putting a slightly different sort of spin in the story. And what we found was it was the Glasgow PR that really kind of captured the imagination of the press, and there was a lot of press interest. So we were picked up with the Independent, the Herald. We were picked up by Reuters as well, who syndicated the story to dozens of news outlets worldwide. And we were also picked up by various radio stations. So we were picked up with the BBC World Service, Radio 4, and the American public radio station as well, which was a massive boost, if you like, to our publicity.
And so had you done radio interviews before?
No, that's the first time I've spoken on radio, I think. It was quite interesting. So I did three interviews in all. So my first interview was on the evening, the day that the paper was released, and I'd been incredibly busy all day. And because it was going out on the BBC World Service, it was going out, they wanted to kind of catch the broadcast going to Africa, because the thought was that there'd be a lot of people there that might be interested in this. Mm-hmm. So I ended up me doing the interview about 11 o'clock at night, sitting in my living room when I was very tired. So that
fully
interview,
dressed.
Fully dressed, yeah. So that interview was actually, I think that was my best one, because I was quite relaxed, really, just because I was utterly knackered. The next interview was, I think, about 6 o'clock in the morning, and that was Radio 4, and that was a bit more nerve-wracking, because that was going out live. So I had to sit there for a minute or two listening to the sports broadcast and the news, and then it was over to me for an interview. So that one was a wee bit more challenging. The one that I think surprised me most was the one for American National Public Radio. So they did an interview with me, and they recorded a few things and then said they'd be back in touch with the details of when the story was going out. And I never heard anything more from them. So my assumption was they'd found something more interesting in the States that day to speak about and weren't running with my story. So I sort of forgot about it for a day or two, and then I got an email from a farmer that I used to work for in Wisconsin in the Midwest of America. So I worked for this man, Jerry Lousted, about 23 years ago. Anyway, he emailed me and said he'd just heard all about my research on American public radio, and he was very thrilled to hear about it, and he passed on all his best regards. And I mean, that really kind of hit home what the sort of the outreach was when you do sort of become involved with the media. So I had no idea that it had gone so far, but I was very pleased to hear from the chap.
Yeah, that's really quite quite good evidence that it really is a small world.
Yeah.
Although I suppose when you've got public radio on your side, then there's fewer than 7 weeks of separation, or however many there's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Another thing that I know happened as a result of this is that social media became quite involved with this story, as well as the kind of traditional radio and journalistic press. What was that like?
That was very interesting as well. So we got picked up in a few different sort of social media sites. So one of the bigger ones was the Scientific American. So that stimulated quite a lot of interest, and a lot of people leaving comments, quite interesting, sensible comments, some less sensible. A lot of people sharing it, so I think we had maybe about 1,000 or so shares there, so people sending it out. A lot of academics saying, oh, that's very interesting, I'm going to use that in my lectures this week. So that was very nice to hear as well. The other sort of big social media splash we had was with the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Science and Reason. So they picked up the story, and the angle they took on it was that we had found proof of evolution.
Has no one found proof of that before?
Yeah.
There was some Charles Darwin or something, I think.
I've definitely heard of him, and I think he definitely deserves some credit there as well.
I think we deserve more.
So that really kind of lit the touch paper, and it stimulated a massive debate, which wasn't particularly sensible, I would say. There were people, basically, it was a sort of battle between people that believe in evolution and people that believe in creation, and this all played out over the course of several hundred Facebook comments. So that was a bit of an eye-opener. I never really expected our research to sort of stimulate such discussion, but very little of the debate in that sort of Facebook sort of kind of commentary really had anything to do with our research at all. It was just using the headline, "We found proof of evolution," and that started the ball rolling. And it was, when you looked at the number of people actually subscribed to the Richard Dawkins website, it's a fairly massive number, but I think half of them are pro and half of them are anti, and they just want to know when it's time for a Barney.
Yeah, you provided the daily dose. Yeah, and they did the rest of it.
So after a few days of this sort of chit-chat, it sort of died down. So that was a very interesting one.
And if I force you to put a number on it, what percentage of comments were wags suggesting that eventually stopping having sex is something that happens other populations and trypanosomes?
I would say probably about 90% of the non sort of evolutionary creationist sort of arguments were, it sounds like me, that's typical after 10 years of marriage, these sort of kind of comments. So
So we can use this podcast as an opportunity to say, don't make that joke to Willie. He's heard it. He's heard it several hundred thousand times now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, Willie. Well, thanks very much for your time, and good luck with all your future research.
Thanks very much, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.